to this news conference with World Bank President Robert Zoellick. Program's in three parts. Mr. Zoellick will make some remarks about his visit today to Geneva, and we'll then be taking questions. We have, as you probably all know, translation. Please keep your questions brief because we'd like to allow as many as we can. And please say your name and the organization you're working for. At the end of the briefing with Mr. Zoellick, Mr. Neufarmer, Richard Neufarmer, who's the representative for the World Bank and the WTO, is available to talk about the fact sheet that we've distributed along with the news release that you all should have. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Zoellick. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. I apologize, I've been rushing around. So we've had a chance to get people my remarks, or was that an open session that we spoke in?
Yes.
It was? Okay. All right. Well, then I'll be very brief. I wanted to come to Geneva for two primary reasons. One is to try to lend my further support to move the Doha agenda forward, and secondly, to announce this seven elements in an effort to try to be more specific in the aid for trade agenda by focusing on our work with countries to integrate trade in their program, which for us is the key to make this work, because our support primarily comes through country assistance strategies, so the countries have to decide they want to integrate it into their program. And then to emphasize, in addition to that, the support we would try to provide in infrastructure as a key element. The trade finance program that IFC has in place, but which we're ramping up, which has the benefits not only of the trade it supports, but helping to develop institutions that can play the trade finance role. The expansion of our overall technical assistance capacity. The work on the trade facilitation and logistics, as some of you probably saw, we put out a report about logistics indicators and rankings, and I've asked our staff whether we could use this in a way similar to the Doing Business report to help countries analyze their own situation and help with diagnostic work, and then perhaps move to the stage of further support as they try to deal with logistics hurdles. And then the ongoing work that we have through the other indicators for trade and competitiveness and our growth strategy. So when I came to the bank, I sat down with the people who do the trade work, and I wanted to see the state of our affairs and see how we could upgrade it, given my background. And I was very pleased that we were able to do this to support the aid for trade method. I just came from a lunch that Pascal hosted with a number of the speakers, and we were talking about follow-up activities. And at least for a number of us that work with countries through the World Bank or the regional development banks, we focused on this critical need to work at the country level to try to integrate this into the activities. So, happy to take your questions.
Okay, questions? Yeah. Gentleman here.
Maybe if you give your name and
associate. Jean-Michel Chade, Estado São Paulo, Brazil. I have two questions, Mr. Zoellick. First, on this announcement that you made today on the $2 billion, is that new money, or you're just using other programs and putting this as a new program? And secondly, on the Doha round itself, you've been here. Remember that during your time, it was not concluded either. What do you make it? Why do you think now it's probably possible to conclude the round? What has changed?
The $2 billion refers to one of the elements, and it's the element dealing with trade finance through IFC, our private sector arm. And what this amounts to is that we are working with smaller financial institutions throughout the developing world to help them to finance imports and exports. And it, the numbers in the fact sheet, I think about 55% of the guarantees relate to Africa, Latin America and the Caribbean, 25%, Middle East, 12%, Europe, 5%, Asia, 3%. And what we do with this program is to help train people to engage in the credit work for either import or export loans to be able to finance transactions, and then connect them with larger international banking institutions so that they have partners as they do the deals. And so this was a project that was begun by IFC about 2 years ago, and the amount of credits that have been supported in the 2 years are about $1.33 billion, but that supports additional amounts of trade because sometimes the credits back other parts of trade that go in participations to other lenders. It supports about $1.8 billion of trade so far. But the $2 billion refers to increasing the amount of trade finance that would be provided through this facility. But most important, actually, there's a reference here to the number of institutions. We're going to try to have the number of banks covered to 260 and increase the number of transactions fivefold to 4,000. The reason why that's particularly important is that if we help these institutions develop the capacity and develop the networks, they can engage in trade finance whether we're involved or not. So our guarantee, this is a good example of how the World Bank as an institution is most effective. We bring knowledge and experience, in this case, state-of-the-art about trade finance. We help develop markets and institutions, in this case, trade credits, and try to help smaller banks have the capacity. And then we have money, which we use in this case to help make the guarantees work so they get the flow, but then the flow can be much larger than our transactions. So that's what that project is about. And it's also a good example of one of the things I've been trying to encourage at the World Bank Group, which is to see how we combine the different arms. I know all of you are trade specialists and you know all the trade details. In the development area, see, we have different tools. We have IDA, the International Development Association, which gives either grants or very concessionary loans to 80 of the poorest countries. Then we have IBRD lending, which is lending that benefits from our AAA rating and is basically about 50 basis points above a U.S. Treasury rate. So in that sense, it's an advantage lending, but it's not subsidized. And then we have IFC, which is our private sector arm that does transactions like this, and we're trying to connect the three. So as for your second question, I think there's been progress made during the period that I was involved in thereafter. And just to give you some, in a sense, hallmarks to emphasize the progress, I remember when we started the round in 2001 that one of the issues that many countries were very focused on was the elimination of export subsidies. Well, that was something we had a commitment to when I was here in July of 2004, but without the end date. Well, now you pretty much are narrowing in on the end date. In July 2004, we had a framework for how we were going to deal with the cuts in domestic support, but you didn't have specifics. And the text that Mr. Falconer put out in the course of this autumn have really narrowed the range that people can be focusing on. So I think having been brought more current on the negotiations, the state of play is that people are trying to narrow the differences in the variables in the ag text. And given the complexities of the ag issues, you may have 15 or 20 roughly key variables. In the goods text, the NAMA text, you really have two key variables. You have the formula and what exceptions to that. And so I think one reason why the NAMA text has seemed to lag the ag discussions is there's fewer items to decide there. And so the report that I have is what's going on now is trying to narrow the difference on the ag items and continue to put focus on the need to have competitive results in the NAMA items. So what I think over the course of from 2001 to 2007, you've had frameworks as you're doing these negotiations that narrow the items. You know, in 2004 we also dropped, you may remember, all the Singapore issues other than trade facilitation. I understand the progress in trade facilitation is pretty good. Since I'm no longer doing this, I don't follow the rules areas closely, but I saw some summaries, and again, they're narrowing down the rules topics. So they're doing what you have to do, which is narrow down the items. But the reason I made the statement I did was that, having been a negotiator, it's easy to focus on the differences of the moment and forget the benefits that you can reap that are already locked into the accord. And I was just suggesting that people shouldn't underestimate those because I think they're quite significant.
Next question, please, and can you say your name and affiliation? Yes, please.
Aude Markovic, Agence France Presse. I wanted to know, if don't you think that in focusing on aid for trade, there is a risk of forgetting the importance of the negotiation and that aid could replace negotiation?
No. The answer was no. And the reason why is that I mean, you cover this topic every day. The people here may wish they could forget it, but they can't. I mean, it's part of everything they live and do. They're not going to be able to escape this. And I think the good news is that the leaders of many of the key countries are interested in trying to achieve a deal. I was just in South Africa, and I talked with President Mbeki, and he was talking about the commitment of South Africa to a deal. About 2 weeks ago, I was in India, and I talked to Prime Minister Singh, and as well as Commerce Minister Nott, my friend, and the Prime Minister is very committed to a deal, and I think Kamal is working towards a deal. I talked with Chancellor Merkel recently. She's committed. I know Gordon Brown's committed. I know President Bush is committed. I haven't talked to President Lula for a while, but I think he's been a committed player. But now the question is, how do you narrow those last differences to make this go forward? And I think that's the challenging task that people have to try to move forward over the next couple months here. And I think the aid for trade actually helps, because for many developing countries, there's a concern that opening markets isn't enough. They need the benefit. So if you take the topic we just discussed, if you're a poor country and you don't have trade finance, you might have goods to sell, but you can't get them into the marketplace. So this shows the possibility of creating additional possibilities to market your goods. I was in Bangladesh recently, and I visited an export zone, and they're very excited about the possibilities of trade, but they need better infrastructure, or as I said in my remarks, they need better energy sources to be able to compete. So I think the commitment of the World Bank, the regional development banks, and others to try to create a better context to capture the benefits of growth and development is one that creates a better environment for the negotiators, but they still have to make their own tough decisions.
Over here, thanks.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Zalek.
God, I was wondering, deja vu, I recognize you all.
Yes, I was wondering if you could
can you
elaborate.
Say who you, sorry,
yes,
say who
I'm John Zarakost.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Zalek, I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the aid for trade. To what extent are you going to home in on the problem of corruption at the sender's end and the receiver's end? Your predecessor, in a keynote speech here last September, highlighted that it takes two to tango.
Well, the governance and anti-corruption agenda has to be part of everything we do. So it not only runs across the support of aid for trade, but it runs across all our development programs. And that's because, first, the undermining, if you have corruption or misuse of funds, it hurts the donors who feel that their money has been lost, but it often is the poor who pay the most because they don't have the benefits of the schools or the projects or the export finance. So one way that we have tried to connect these is with an initiative that I launched with the UN a couple months ago, which is called the STARS Initiative. It's the Stolen Asset Recovery Initiative, where we are working with countries that have had assets stolen, often by corrupt leaders, to take advantage of a UN treaty that makes it easier for them to get the legal assistance to recover those assets. And this is a case of where, using the two to tango, you need support of the developed countries to be able to recover the assets. And here I want to thank the Swiss government that has been very active in support and has a couple of members on the advisory committee of our STARS initiative, because I think they recognize the reputational effect of not being supportive of this. The other aspect, though, not to lose sight of, is that when you create more competition through trade, you tend to remove the opportunities for corruption by people controlling preferred access or special licensing or other customs regimes. So we do a separate report called our Doing Business Report, which helps countries analyze how easy it is to start a business, close a business, get credit. And while that's not only a tool for entrepreneurs, it's a tool for entrepreneurs, but it's also a tool to address corruption, because the less licensing, the less regulation, the less opportunities you have for bureaucrats to extract economic rents from business people. So it has to run through everything we do. And one of the reasons I thought, always felt trade, you know, as a competitive device was leveled the playing field, is that in most countries, if you ask who has the trade barriers, they're the preferred groups. They're often oligopolies, oligarchies that have the favorite access. So you open access, you lower the price of goods for consumers, and you also lower the price of inputs for other producers, as I said in my remarks.
There was a question over here on the left.
Assis Moreira, Valor Econômico de Brasil, Econômico Daily. Mr. Zelica, do you see any impact of the depreciation of dollar on the negotiations, Doha Round, or even in the programs for aid for trade?
I'm sorry, was the question about the depreciation of the dollar on the Doha Round?
And the aid for trade as well.
Hmm?
Yes, the depreciation of dollar. Yes.
Yeah. I haven't encountered that here. You know, during the course of trade negotiations in the past, you've had some significant currency adjustments. It's true during the course of the Uruguay round two. And I think that in general, countries look upon the trade barriers as a medium and long-term exercise, and they realize that currency rates will adjust. I think for some countries that have run large current account deficits, like the United States, it can contribute to protectionism. And that's a reason why the trade deals are important to proceed with. Because, you know, as you have an environment where people, it's interesting, if you look at the U.S. politically, you often find movements towards protectionism associated with high current accounts, regardless of the state of the economy. So when I was in the U.S. Treasury in the 1980s, you had a very large current account until some of the, you had a very large current account deficit that started to change in the late 80s, and that was the time you had a big surge of protectionism. And I saw this during the course of the past years in the U.S. as well. So in that sense, it's all the more reason why I think a successful trade round will help combat the protectionist forces. And those, I do think, are part, not just with some developed countries, but you see it in competition with developing countries, as I'm sure you're well aware, too. So, you know, when I was in Bangladesh, when I was in Pakistan, when I've been in some African countries, there was the question of their ability to compete with China. And so this is an element that I think affects the South-South trade as well as the traditional trade patterns.
I'm okay. You're okay. Actually, there was a question down here from the gentleman.
Ambassador Zelek, sorry, now you are the managing director. So, Mr. Zelek,
I'm not either. That's okay.
That's fine. Thank you. My name is Ravi Kant. I represent Washington Trade Daily. I have three questions.
Only?
Yes.
You're losing your touch.
To start with, first and foremost, should the Doha round die a natural death because of the U.S. failure, because of the U.S. administration's failure to secure trade promotion authority? Will Aid for Trade go as an independent vehicle and getting implemented? I mean, would you foresee that possibility? The second question, Mr. Zelek, you launched Doha round on the promise that it will be a developmental round in which market access as well as distortions in trade subsidies will be the two major components that will help the developing countries. Now, Aid for Trade is brought primarily to address what has been failed to address through market access and subsidies. Will that be a kind of option that you would have liked if you continued as the trade as the ambassador for the U.S. trade? And lastly, Mr. Zelek, I mean, in case if despite all your best efforts, what would you tell the U.S. administration? I mean, particularly we have an administration which doesn't know whether it will get the Trade Promotion Authority and how it should go about.
I'm going to combine your first question with its two parts with your last one, okay? Because the way you phrase it is, should it fail? And I want to make clear, no, it shouldn't, okay? But you then connected it to Aid for Trade. Then Aid...
I have connected it to the failure of the U.S. to secure trade promotion.
Well, that's your last one. Anyway, let me try, and if I don't get it, you can come back. I've always believed that it's hard to beat something with nothing, and therefore it's important to be on offense in trade and to have agreements that you can point to. So if you go back and look at the strategy that I pursued in 2001, I was pursuing both trade promotion authority, not both, I was pursuing trade promotion authority, a Doha launch, and bilateral and regional agreements. And so the hardest thing to do was to get trade promotion authority separate from agreements, because you're trying to get a generalized authority and all the opponents can point to the fears they have. And the proponents, the supporters, don't have an agreement to back. So I believe that the potential global trade agreement would be a good substantive agreement for the U.S. as well as others. And so I believe the U.S. should go for it and then present it to the Congress. And that will be the best way to mobilize business groups, agricultural groups, others that will benefit from the trade agreement. So, and the alternative is not doing anything. That certainly won't move it forward. So I believe it's best to be on offense and to be bringing agreements. Now, the way that I was trying to do that was to have a portfolio of agreements. So you're bringing agreements all the time and constantly organizing the pro-trade community to support them. This wasn't easy because you were constantly having to bring agreements. But if you look at some of the votes of those agreements, you know, for example, it had the minority support that we had for Australia or Singapore or Chile was very similar to the amount you just had for this Peru vote. So it's possible to do it. Now, as for the connection with Aid for Trade, aid for trade is beneficial under any circumstances because we have a trading system, we have trade agreements in place, we want to help developing countries take advantage of those trade agreements. However, I think it, in the current environment, it at least is another statement of support for developing countries, particularly poorer ones, that might worry that a trade agreement may not be something that they will be able to secure the benefits from. It shows the interest of others in trying to support them. And then you had a question about subsidies and market access. At least as I understand the range that people are negotiating in, I think there's some very significant gains to be achieved, and people need to keep in mind, if you don't secure this agreement, well, then you have the Eurogray round levels as your tops, and if you think that there's dangers of protectionism or desire to have subsidies and support, those are your ceilings. So it'd be much better to eliminate export subsidies, to drastically reduce the subsidies that are in the blue and the yellow box, and to get significant increases in market access. So I think those are all beneficial for the system, and that's why I would urge that to move forward. See, I always felt this was the win-win venture because it not only was good trade policy, but it's good domestic policy. And, you know, spending large money on farm subsidies doesn't strike me as good domestic policy either.
Simple question which I forgot to ask you. Namely, you were the author of the framework agreement, and in that there is this what is called the NAMA, non-agricultural market access, where you built in the principle called less than full reciprocity, in which you said that developing countries will take lesser commitments than the developed countries. And now the current formula that is being considered will give developed countries to take much lesser contributions than developing countries. Will you accept that kind of a framework?
Well, I accept that. Well, sure. I'm not a negotiator, and the framework is now up to the negotiators. I think, however, the interpretation you're putting on it, one has to be careful because there's another argument on that. If you start with many developed countries having lower tariffs and having the bound tariffs the same as applied tariffs, I think the question is, you know, who's doing more if you are taking an amount down from a higher level but you still end up higher, or you are taking water out of a tariff and not going down to a bound tariff, is that more than when you're cutting a bound tariff? And so I'm not going to, you know, that's not my point to debate, but I think the way you stated it represented one side of the argument, and not surprisingly there's another side, and that's why people are negotiating. But I would come back to this point. If you look at the statement that I gave, or you look at the history of the ITA, keep in mind, when most economists do assessment of benefits of trade agreements, they don't just focus on exports. The real benefits for a country's economic welfare come from lowering the barriers. It lowers the costs for inputs for goods. It lowers the costs for consumers. And increasingly, in a world of interconnected supply chains, that's very important. That's why I put in the example about the iPod, and there's eight different components in terms of the processor. And so one of the striking things, if you look, and this is where the East Asian countries were very successful, the ITA basically created huge opportunities for interconnected logistics chains of production sourcing. And so everybody benefits from that, and that's reflected in some of the booming trade flows you have in Asia. So, you know, right now we're in an era where you have very good commodity prices. So some countries are doing real well with their commodities. But, you know, the history is those prices go up and down. And I truly believe that a more open environment for manufacturing tariffs in the next 10 or 15, 20 years will probably be of greatest benefit to many of the developing countries. Because if you just look at the pattern of who's moving up the manufacturing value-added chain, I've got to suspect that Latin America, China, India, and others are going to be very efficient players in manufacturing. And that doesn't mean there's not a role for higher-end manufacturing for North America and Europe, but the real point here is the protectionism of today that leads countries to be afraid to cut some of those barriers could ironically hurt their own development as manufacturing players 5-10 years from now. Yeah, one more.
Mr. Zalek, I was wondering...
Sorry,
I just want to make sure I give everybody a chance.
Yeah.
Brad Klepper from Associated...
Sorry, actually, it was a gentleman here. Can you introduce yourself?
Jonathan Lynn from Reuters. Just picking up on your points about commodity prices, how worried are you that the current record oil and commodity prices will prompt over-aggressive borrowing by developing countries against possibly unrealistic revenue targets? And do you think that emerging market economies are shockproof or more shockproof from the global credit crunch and the slowing world economy than the rich countries and the way that now many investors are pricing the assets of developing countries suggests?
I think there's still more shakeouts in financial markets, and therefore it's not clear how the financial market adjustment process will still affect the real economies. But I think this is a period still of some uncertainty of economic growth, which is one reason why a positive step like closing the Doha round, I think, would be very good for the global economy. Second, if you look at developing countries' borrowing spreads, so these are the interest rates that they pay above some benchmark, whether LIBOR or U.S. Treasuries, when the credit readjustment started to take place in the summer, those spreads expanded, but they've tended to come back down. So unlike past periods of financial turmoil, the emerging markets have actually been more solid. Third, I think this is a function of the fact that in general, those countries have developed sounder budget policies, sound macroeconomic policies, better monetary policies, and many of them are buoyed up by other poles of growth, including China and India and Asia. Next, I don't believe that the world economy is decoupled, but I do think you have multiple poles of growth. And so if the United States changed from slow growth to a recession, I do think that would affect Europe, and eventually it would also affect the developing economies. So it's one reason why, again, a global trade round that encourages growth and would be positive for development. Then you had a question that was related, to the commodity prices more generally. I don't mean to suggest that I see an imminent sort of shift in commodity prices. If anything, my comments that I've made in a couple of sessions in recent days reflect that I'm concerned about the effect of high oil and food prices on some of the poorest countries that do not have offsetting benefits from increased prices for other commodities. So, say, Zambia has copper, so it has its benefit from the higher copper price, even though it hasn't had others. But at the recent G20 meeting in Cape Town, I mentioned a number of, I gave a number of the names, but of some 17 economies that we've looked at that I think are going to be particularly hard hit by the food and agricultural price, and the energy prices. And so I was saying that it's important for the world to try to think how we can help these countries adjust. And so, for example, I'm in the process of trying to
raise funds for IDA 15, which is the 15th replenishment of IDA, which is the funds we use for the poorest countries. And one reason I've said this is important is that's the funding mechanism we tend to use if, for a country example, has followed good economic reforms, but it, for example, it's in the process of trying to deal with high energy prices. Maybe it's had some subsidy of the energy prices and they want to change it, but they can't change it immediately. How do we cushion the blows of those things? And I also talked about how the type of support the bank gives for infrastructure reforms, again, in an energy sector would be important so that countries can cushion the blow. These are not things that necessarily totally protect them from the change of higher energy prices or food prices, but they help them adjust more effectively. And I was suggesting among the leading developing economies and developed economies that I think this is a subject we need to give further consideration to for some of these particularly poor countries. And I would add, this is also where you start to create some of the fragility that might affect political dynamics. I was at a session last night with the EU development ministers talking about conflict states and post-conflict states and fragile situations, and these all become part of an interconnected dynamic. If you're trying to help Cote d'Ivoire, you're trying to help Liberia, these countries can get hit very hard by some of these adjustments. So that's the context in which I'm most concerned about commodity prices in the near future. The reference I made earlier was just that if you look at markets, you know, the history of markets is that eventually those commodity prices tend to come down. I believe there's structural reasons why the energy prices will stay high for a while.
Okay, I'm afraid that's all.
This fellow didn't have one. Did you want one?
Do you want one?
From Associated Press, Brad Clapper. I just wanted to ask you about services, banking, telecoms, insurance, big things in the world economy that the Doha Round hasn't really gained too much traction on, even as we talk about agriculture, however big that is for the world economy. 4 years ago, the USTR, under your leadership, proposed that developing countries should bind their existing treatment of services, and that proposal has come up in different forms for the last 4 years and always sternly rejected. And I'm wondering, in a Doha agreement, what's going to happen in the next year or 2 years to really change opinions? Because I don't see much traction. Is this something that the U.S., the EU, and others are going to give up on, or are developing countries just going to realize they've been making a big mistake all these years?
Let me answer this in parts. The short answer in terms of what's going to happen in negotiations is that you've got more knowledgeable people here than I in terms of that. I'm not as close to that anymore. Second, I believe then and now that there are some important gains for economy by having a more open service sector, and I touched on some of those in my remarks. So there's an irony here. We're trying to help countries develop export finance. Well, more openness in financial services will probably help you have a more efficient trade sector. Africa has been a wonderful example of a booming private sector telecommunications industry because of some opening in telecommunications policies. If you think about the transportation sector, the ability to get air cargo in and out has been the key for Kenya developing a flour industry for Europe and Colombia doing flour exports. So part of the work that I hope we can do on aid for trade is to show how it's in countries' interests to have a more open and competitive services market. But that's for the countries to determine, and as you see, even in some of the examples in the fact sheet, some companies or countries will do this unilaterally because they see the benefits. Third, in terms of the negotiations, at the time that I was leaving, I was recommending a different focus, which I think was pursued more at Hong Kong. And the point of that is, agriculture and goods in this round, and this is one reason why there's some significant things on the table, had a very different approach for those of you that studied trade before, which was before you used to have the request offer system and then you had the MFN benefit. This was using formulas, and it was using formulas that, frankly, cut higher barriers more, whether they were subsidies or whether they were tariffs. That's very significant policy shift. The services weren't really part of that because they don't lend themselves to that. And so the services were more of either a standstill or a request offer system. My own view was that to bring along support for a global trade round, it probably made most sense to focus on a limited number of important markets and a limited number of core services. And I think that's what they've done to make this more manageable. And I suspect that if you are able to have the breakthrough on agriculture and goods, you'll see that process move more quickly. It just hasn't moved because the others, in a sense, are a prerequisite. But it's interesting that the shift that I was suggesting was one that reflected more the political needs to back an agreement as opposed to what some developing countries might want to do in their own interest. So, as is often the case in trade, it's an unusual type of negotiation because it's not like buying a house where you either, it's a zero sum, you pay more, you pay less. In trade, if you, quote, give up more, you're really opening up your economy and making it more efficient, which is why it was actually fun to be a trade negotiator because, you know, the real challenge was dealing with the politics of opening it up because otherwise you're doing something that's in your own economic interest to do. Okay?